Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? It's Mark Maron, me. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to it. Broadcasting from the new space, the new garage. I did have a spin out. I will tell you about it. I feel okay right now, but I definitely went into a vortex the other day. A lot of things going on. Having a hard time talking today. I just did 2 hours doing a book on tape reading for Amber Tamblyn's new book. She asked me to do a part, basically, and it took a lot out of me. It took a lot of my mouth, out of my tongue, out of my heart, out of my mind. It's a beautifully written thing, and I don't know when it's coming out. I put a lot into it, and it wore my mouth out. But anyway, Jason Alexander is on the show today. We're going to talk about, I think he just wanted to come by. I think that was really the idea. I think he's going to be doing a live concert with the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra on April 14th and 15th at the New Jersey Performance Arts Center in Newark and State Theater in New Brunswick. But aside from that, I think he just wanted to come by and hang out in the old garage. I'm still moving through many interviews that were done in the old space. But you want to hear about my spin out? I don't know if you know this about me. I don't know how much you know about me. But if I decide there's something horribly wrong, I'll generally do everything in a flurry of obsessive compulsion to correct it, even if I'm making it up in my mind. That's the way I get things done sometimes. And that's the way I overdo things sometimes. I was incredibly nervous, as you know, from the last from the first broadcast from the new space here. About how it would sound, how it would feel, what's happening, you know, what am I going to do? I got to get books set up. I got to get the space buffered. What if it doesn't work out? What if the buffering doesn't work? What if if it doesn't sound good? A lot of things were going through my mind because I did have my first guest interview in here the other day. You're not going to hear it today, but you'll hear it in the future. And it went great. It went better than anticipated. So here's what happens leading up to the first interview I had here in the new space. A few days ago, before I had set up and I was in between the old garage and the new garage and not knowing whether or not this would be up and running, I scheduled to do an interview at another space, at a studio. It's not going to be on for a long time, so I don't know that I need to tell you who it is because you'll get excited. You'll be beside yourself. You'll be chomping at your bit. Champing at the bit or whatever it is, you'll get anxiety over, you'll be impatiently waiting. John Cleese. It was John Cleese. So, and that was a classic setup for a dumb dump of a punchline. Not that John Cleese is a dumb dump of a punchline, just the, I can't do it, I won't do it, I'm doing it. Classic joke garbage 101. But while I'm there, I noticed a kid who's working the board. You know, he's a kid who works the board. He's there. He's obviously paid by the company that owns the studio. He's a trusted guy. And, you know, we were talking sound. We were talking, the soundless spaces, the dead spaces, the studio, what you do to have it completely insulated for sound. So, you know, you can clap and it just gets sucked away. You hear no bounce. But we were talking about sound. I told him what was up and he gave me his number out of nowhere. He said, I'm a consultant and I can come over. And I'm like, all right, I might need this. And then I got home and then I immediately started obsessing. I recorded what you heard was the first intro. And I just started freaking out about, wow, is it good? Is it bad? Is the sound right? So then I call this kid in a panic. And I'm like, when can you come over? He's like, I can come over in a couple hours. He comes over in a couple hours and he brings these things that he made for himself. He's basically tells me he just got out of college. He's building this audio consulting and and you know, studio guy business. And he comes in to give me a consultation, and he says, well, I got my panels out in the car. And he brings in these four foam panels. Like, they're just straight up foam. There's no covering on them, and they're sort of sitting on bases with dowels that are running halfway up the foam, and then they're taped on with black electrical tape. So they're just freestanding, but they definitely don't look like you bought them at a store. They definitely look hand rigged. So he brings those in, and we talk about the ceiling, we talk about the side of the over here, we talk about the back here, and you know what he can do and this and that. He gives me some recommendations. I go, all right. And then I just freak out, and I'm like, well, I don't know, man, it sounds pretty good right now. Can you just leave your panels, your homemade doweled, supported with splints, giant pieces of foam here? I'll pay you for the consultation, and I'll pay you to rent these from you until I get a permanent solution. So that's what's going on in here. So I've got these panels in here, and I kind of moved them around. And hold on, I think I'm going to move one now. Hold on. I'm going to move this one over here a little, because that's what I'm feeling mystically. See, now in my mind, that's a lot better, because I moved them over there. I moved one about a half a foot in. That's the world I'm living in. I am obsessively moving these panels around, not knowing if they're doing anything. And it sounds fine to me in my head. It actually sounds pretty good. But so I've got my first guest coming over, and I don't need to tell you who it is, because it's not going to be on for a while. And there's no point in me, you know, getting you anxious and excited and, full of anticipation. There's no reason for me to even, you know, tip to you who the first guest I interviewed in the garage was. It was Josh Brolin. And he strikes me as a sort of an intimidating person to begin with, but I've been wanting to talk to him for a while. I think he's a tremendous actor. So I'm waiting for Josh Brolin. It's an hour or two before he comes over. I'm sitting out here in the garage. I'm putting books out. I'm trying to clean things up so at least looks a little, not settled per se, but at least it looks like there are, you know, things in the right place, books up. Yeah, I just wanted to be able to explain everything as something temporary, and you know, not feel like an asshole. So about an hour and a half before Brolin comes over, I'm sitting in this chair, and out the window over here, which is not great for sound either, out the window, as if it were just outside the window, I hear somebody using a tool that I've never heard before. And this is day one, first guest in here. I'm scheduled to talk to Josh at 12:30. At 11 o'clock, I hear a tool that sounds like several hammerheads attached to a jackhammer being used on the outside of a wall for of a box that has nothing inside of it. It's just this ricocheting sound of a rapid fire hammering tool. And of course, my response was like, are you fucking kidding me? Is this like, is this God's ironic sense of humor that he's going to put me through this shit? So I leave my space here, and I walk out into the street of my new neighborhood, and directly across the street, catty corner, there's some guy sawing on a front porch for something they're gutting over there. And I'm trying to figure out where the fuck the machine gun style jackhammer hammering instrument is coming from. And that's way across your street, three houses down. I see these guys, and I'm wandering around. I think I have my headphones still on outside. I unplugged them, and I'm just wandering around with my hands outspread in the middle of the street looking for the sound. These two guys who are working on a porch down the street there see me, and I'm just standing there with a baffled and aggravated look on my face with my hands outspread, and one of them comes up to me and goes, yeah, is okay? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And that's not a Mexican accent. That's a vague, might be Armenian, not sure, might be Italian. I don't know. That wasn't from here. There's no reason for me to do it. I just want you to know that whatever I'm attempting to do is a broad-based foreigner accent that could apply to many different types of ethnicities. And I said, how long is it going to go on for, the noise? He goes, maybe 10 minutes. And I'm like, 10 minutes, that's it? He goes, oh, then we go around back. And again, for an hour. And I'm like, what, an hour? And he goes, maybe we use smaller, I'm like, okay. So an hour max? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, all right. Because I figure Josh is not going to be here till 12:30. Then I come back in here sweating. I'm sweating and panicking because I don't know if the foam's going to do it. I don't know what's going to fucking do it. I don't know if I'm going to have to move the show to another goddamn place. And I hear the hammering, and then I just move this one foam panel that's about 5 inches thick that's being held up by stilts on a small platform of wood and taped. I move this just slightly, angle it in front of the window, and it's a miracle. I can barely hear the weird machine. And I'm like, wow, maybe this is going to work out. And then I go out and wait for Josh, and he walks in. And I was concerned that, like, with these weird stilted pieces of foam, that it would look too professional. That was my fucking concern, that someone would walk in here and go like, oh, this is a professional operation. Yeah, you can tell by the wood that was bought at the Michael's Crafts, that wherever the fuck. Anyway, that's not how it went. My point is that I was sweating and spun out for nothing because I tried to solve problems that may or may not be there, but I tried to solve them preemptively to them even happening, and made myself completely crazy as if I had bought the wrong house. And here I am talking to you. Just want you to remember who I am and how some things apparently will never fucking change. So I guess the moral of this story is, outside of me being consistent in this strange behavior of spiraling and anxiety and things I made up in my head, is that I told the kid, Julian, the kid who leased me his foam panels propped up by dowels, who's starting a business. He's a young kid. He's starting a business. He's starting an audio consulting business, and he offered to make me professional panels. And I thought, not unlike when I started the old garage and Laughing Andy from an old radio show that I used to do brought over his foam to help me get started. This guy is starting a business. He's a young guy, and he made me a price. He offered me a price on making nice panels for this that I can move around on the sides and maybe put some up on the wall and the ceiling. And he said he'd give me a consultation and install them and everything. And I thought, well, that's the way to do it. I could have ordered from a catalog, but this kid is making a go at it, so I'm going to give him a go. So he's going to make that for me, and I'll get those in a month or so. But I'm going away for a few weeks, so I gave him that time to do that. He said he could get it all done by next week. And I said, take it easy, pal. If you just leave the ones here that are propped up, you know, the ones with the tape, you know, up until you get the good ones in, I'm good. So that's our agreement. So I'll let you know how that comes out and how that goes. Jason Alexander is a great guy. I'm glad we talked. He's exactly who you think he is. And that's comforting. As I said earlier, he's going to be doing a live concert with the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra on April 14th and 15th. That's at the New Jersey Performance Arts Center in Newark and State Theater in New Brunswick. So this is me and Jason actually talking in the old garage.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
I did, you know, that's the weird thing. You drove up in your whatever that was.
That's a Prius Prime.
Prius
part
Prime?
Of the solution.
You're probably
it's a, and relatively good. New. I've good only had you. It about a month.
Well, that's a a budget conscious solution doer. Could have bought it electric. You don't want electric.
No, you know in? Why? I like most Jews.
Yeah.
Know that at some point I'm going to have to flee.
Right.
And the electric doesn't give you enough distance.
60 miles is not enough?
One tank of gas and a full charge, that puppy should go 650 miles, which will get me at least in Nevada.
Oh, yeah, much better there.
Yeah.
You'll meet the other Jews that are fleeing. And eventually you get to the middle of the...
Because no one's going
to
target Vegas.
That's right. Sure. You'll get to the middle of the country. It's going to be nothing but fleeing Jews from both coasts going like, what do we do now? And you're right where they want them.
How did all these Jews get to Wisconsin?
Yeah, and how they're just going to build a fence around the Jews that ran from both coasts.
That's right.
Oh no, you're gonna need a plane, buddy.
You betcha.
You're gonna need a are you do you know when the timing are you up on the timing like do you know when we go
no Is I don't that's the problem I'm not in the loop
yeah who's in the loop
well I am such a peripheral Jew that I'm not even gonna get the memo. I'm not on the email chain.
I know you're a fairly public Jew. I imagine that people you know, when they think Jew, they're probably an example that that anti-Semites use, like, for you know, like, you don't know what a Jew is?
That's right. Look at this bald bastard. He screams Jew.
Oh my God. I hope it doesn't come to that. You know, I was panicking at the beginning. I'm like, I got to get a new passport. Bannon's probably got my name on the list. I was going nuts at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And then my girlfriend said, like, I don't think they're after you. And that's a cold comfort. You're like, yeah, you're right. You know, not yet. You
know? Yeah, I haven't made the list.
Well, no. It's sort of like, it's probably, you know, there's a couple other ethnicities before Jews at this particular juncture in history.
Yeah, he's looking for a Jew. He wants his Roy Cohn. I'm going into law school.
Oh, yeah, you're gonna flip sides. Like, hey, fuck. You know what I mean? I can keep living here.
Really?
But aside from that, Jews from New Jersey. I'm genetically Jersey.
Yeah.
You are, you know, full on Jersey. Like, I only spent the first 6 years of my life in Jersey.
Oh, really?
But I always went back because the family was always there.
You're never going to get away.
No, but I've gotten, it's true. But yeah. I think it's in me deeper than I thought. Both of the parents are from Jersey.
Sure.
But I feel like I'm Jersey. Do I feel Jersey to you?
Yeah, I would have said, oh, this guy feels comfortable.
Yeah.
He feels like he's been through Elizabeth and smelled that fabulous aroma.
The Secaucus aroma.
Secaucus has it.
So what town did you grow up in?
I started.
You started? Is that you talk about when you're born?
I began. I played. I lived 2 years in Irvington, New Jersey. Then we moved upscale to Maplewood, New Jersey, and then we moved further upscale to Livingston, New Jersey.
Now Livingston, I know, because that seemed like there was. It was. I remember the signs. Because my grandmother, like, you go to Livingston. I feel like, you know, the signs for Livingston.
Well, we had a mall. It wasn't Short Hills-esque, but we had a mall. And the reason we were there is my mother was a big muckety-muck. She sort of founded and ran the School of Nursing at St. Barnabas Medical Center.
Uh-huh.
So that's, hence, Livingston.
That's why you were there?
Yeah.
How many siblings?
A half of each. One of them is deceased.
Sorry.
That's all right. Thank you.
A half of each?
Yeah. My father was a widower. So I'm my mother's only child.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, actually. Carrying them, you know, being the Messiah is not an easy thing.
It's not. She had it relied on you a lot?
Yeah.
There's a lot weighing on you?
There was, you know, actually it was great because my mother was a career woman at a time when most women were not.
Right.
My mother was the major breadwinner in our house. My father always worked, but my mother was the major breadwinner.
At the nursing school?
Yeah.
Teaching?
She ran it. She created the curriculum. She ran that. She was the executive director. She was on, I don't know if it's still around, but there was a national organization of nurses that she was on that board as well. She was a big honcho in the nursing
world.
Yeah.
And so she was a nurse her whole life?
Whole life.
Wow. And what did your dad do?
He did a variety of things.
One of those guys.
You know, dad, I'm never sure how much of the history is dead on accurate and how much of it is urban legend.
Is he around?
My dad died in 2001. He was 91 years old when he died. Wow. My mom is about to turn 98 this month.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. My dad...
It's great. Congratulations on the genes.
Much. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
My dad, as a young man, supposedly did some work for the Jewish mob on the Lower East Side of New York. Then became a Pinkerton detective. I don't know how you make that transition.
He was a mole. He's a rat.
I guess.
He was on the inside.
He worked for Bell Laboratories during World War II as a project manager, although he never had a college education, so I'm not quite sure.
Bell Laboratories for the military?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And then he, my lifetime, he was a transit bus driver from Bayonne, New Jersey into New York, back and forth that route. He was
an
account manager for a brush manufacturing company. I mean, he did all kinds. He sold life insurance for New York Life for a while. He was all over the map.
It's quite a mythic resume.
Yeah. He was an interesting guy.
Well, you got to assume that it's sort of like, it sounds pretty real because no one's going to throw in, you know, the bus driver from Bayonne in New York.
No, that I know for a fact.
Right. That part of it, that validates a lot. You know, the working for the mob one, maybe.
Well, the only reason I tend to buy that is if you look at my bar mitzvah photo album.
Yeah.
You know, the table shots. So you see table Jews. And you get to one table and you go, holy shit, what am I looking at? And it's a couple of guys I know for a fact, you know, were killed in jail because they.
Really?
They were. Yeah. My father says he wasn't a collector, he certainly wasn't a violence guy, but I guess he had some relations, hence the Pinkerton detective.
He drove the truck.
He had some relationships with the police precinct down in the Lower East Side of New York, and he used to go in, when the guys got arrested, he used to go in and kind of get them out.
Oh, really?
So he was friends with those guys, and he would say, I was affiliated, and I think he just kind of knew them. And
so he'd go schmooze the cops to let the guys out?
And when I graduated high school, my dad, God bless him, he gave me a piece of paper, not high school, college. He gave me a piece of paper and he said, look, I can't give you very much, but there's a phone number here.
Yeah.
If you ever need anything, you call this number, you tell them you're my kid.
Yeah.
And be taken care of. And I went, are you out of your goddamn mind? You handed me a loaded gun. What are you doing?
Look, you're going to have to pay for it for the rest of your life.
Right,
and the VIG's pretty heavy.
But he was deadly serious. He said, you need anything, this is the phone number.
Did you call?
No, I threw it away.
You threw it away?
You bet.
Right then?
Right then and
after
there.
After we walked away?
No, I said, Dad, I can't. Please, don't do this to me.
Who did you think it was?
It was a number for a guy that would do whatever you need. But, you go, I'm Al's kid, and he would go, what do you need? I need this guy killed. I need whatever.
I think your father was assuming that wouldn't be the request.
Make no assumptions with my dad.
Was he a hard guy or not?
No, he was. By the time I came along, he was 50 years old when I was born. So by the time I came around, he was a pug from the Lower East Side of New York. And as a young man, he was always an ethical guy. He was a good man, but he was a pug. He had a bad temper. And but by the time I came around, he had mellowed.
Yeah.
And I said to my half-brother at my dad's funeral, I said, the reason you and I are so different is not that we had different mothers. We had different fathers.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, my dad was just a very sweet man and so clearly adored me from the minute I was born that I had all that.
Yeah, you got the good stuff because, you're how most people treat the first grandkid.
Right, exactly.
Right, right. These other two.
Yeah.
I did what I could, but this one going to get all the good stuff.
He was, by the time I came around, he was a pussycat.
Uh-huh. It happens in your 50s. How old are you?
58.
And what, really?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Yeah. And I'm a September baby like you. And, I just started saying 58 and I feel like it's half gone.
Yeah.
By the time I get used to the number, it changes again. It's going very
fast. September 1, did you research on me?
No, but I know you're a September guy. I think you're a little left. I'm the 23rd.
I'm the 27th.
There you go.
So you're Libra too?
I'm right on the cusp. Yeah. But I am a Libra. If you go by the descriptions, I'm more Libra than Virgo.
Yeah. But when people ask you, do you say Libra?
No, I say I'm right on the cusp. I'm more. I just said it, Mark.
I'm sorry, but what does that mean? You can't be two.
Yeah, some charts have me as a Virgo and some have me as a Libra.
Oh,
depends
really?
How who's doing the chart.
The fuck? Do you put any credence in that?
Not as far as predicting anything.
Yeah.
It is interesting, and I don't know if you could do this with any other of these pseudo sciences, but. The generalized descriptions of people that fall into the signs, I find there is a general accuracy to that.
Huh.
And I'm not sure why that is.
What makes us Libras? I'm never quite clear. Is it like
a sense of looking for balance, preoccupation with justice and injustice?
Uh-huh. See, it's now starting to sound like borderline personality disorder. It's the same.
For me, it's the fact that the symbol is a scale. So my fat ass is constantly reminded that I should drop a few.
That's how you take it?
That's how I take it. It's so God's little thumb.
Your other siblings, which one passed? Your brother?
My sister. You have sister? My sister passed away about 3 years ago.
I'm sorry. Yeah. And what did they do? What were they like?
My brother was career military. Oh, my really? Brother is 20 years older than me.
20 years older than you?
Yeah. So he was career Air Force for almost 30 years. He left the service as a lieutenant colonel.
Was your dad's first wife full Jew too?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then my brother worked as a field investigator for the IRS for several years. And then he did something else. I'm not sure what. And then it's been retired for a while. And wow. My sister had been ill for most of her life. She had a disease that she and I went to work for called scleroderma. It's in the autoimmune lupus family.
Right.
But she had done a lot of things. She had worked as an accountant. She had taught Latin at high school level when that was a thing.
Yeah.
You know, she, for a woman that should have been on disability all her life, she had a pretty active life.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. All right. So when does, so you're in Jersey, you're the young kid amongst the I mean, your brother's out of the house already.
Oh, yeah. I never grew up with my brother. My sister was there for 5 years and then she
So you're like almost the only child.
I was more or less raised as an only child.
And what compels you to entertain? Were you a child entertainer?
Not knowingly. I was, and people, unless they really know me, they go, come on. I was a very shy, very somber, very frightened, cowed little kid.
Really?
And
I believe that.
I didn't have a lot of friends, and I was kind of a loner. I mean, I had my friend Bruce Davison who lived down the block, but so I'd come home, and like all little kids that feel lost and lonely and scared, I discovered magic. And I started trying to do
you had the box.
Magic. I had the magic kit, and I got the books, and I was pretty serious about it. And I thought that it was going to be what I did, never thinking it was performing.
Yeah,
I just thought, oh, it's fun to feel powerful,
you right? Know? And know that there's a trick behind everything.
Correct. And around when I was 12 or 13, we moved from Maplewood to Livingston.
Yeah,
and I didn't know a damn soul in Livingston. And the first kids I met were the theater kids,
and
they
school?
Pulled me at Livingston High.
Yeah.
Actually, Heritage Middle School and then Livingston High.
So, did you use the magic to sort of open conversations with girls?
No,
and stuff?
Girls. Like, girls.
Oh, sorry.
Well, please, you know. But it was a girl. My parents, we moved there in the summer before I was going to start seventh grade.
Yeah.
And my parents, because they both work, said, we signed you up for the community pool. Which is beautiful because I weigh about 500 pounds,
and I'm
pasty and white. And,
you were always a little heavy.
No, I was at least 30 pounds overweight.
But you're not.
Kid.
You look good.
I'm okay. All right. I can get sick and survive. So yeah. That's what my mother says. And I'm in the pool and I don't know a damn soul. And this gorgeous young girl comes up and goes, "Hi, you're new. Do you sing?" And I went, "Yeah, kind of." And she pulled me into this production of Sound of Music that the local teen theater was doing.
You're 14 or so?
What are you? I was 12 or 13.
Yeah, yeah.
And I met all these kids, and I suddenly had friends and community, and I went, hey, this stage thing is pretty good. I could hide in plain sight. I didn't feel like I was me when I was performing. I was whoever the person was. So that was kind of cool, and I just liked hanging with these kids, so I started going to the theater in New York a lot and doing all the plays at school.
So it's cool, because they were misfits, and, you know, or not misfits, but theater kids are different.
They weren't the coolest kids.
No, of course not, but they would turn out, you know, they were sort of... I think a lot of the theater kids, in my memory, is that, like, they had this capacity to just sort of... like live through the parts and sing out loud.
Oh,
like they weren't.
Oh, sure. It was a lot like Glee.
Right. They weren't effective. Right.
No, they had no guile. Really.
Right. Right.
You know, some of them were manufacturing some attitudes and persona in order to cope. But they were all, what was nice about the theater kids is they were generally nice guys. They were nice people.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't out to hurt feelings. There were no bullies in the theater community.
Manufacturing attitudes and personas to cope.
Yeah. That's,
I think I'm still doing that.
I think we all are. I think people are seeing through mine at this point. But.
I believe you were a shy kid. Why wouldn't you be? I mean, you know.
Well, you know, it was funny, and I always thought it was very obvious, but I remember when I was in college, I went to Boston University as a theater major,
uh-huh.
and I I started dating this girl and who I hadn't really known, and we had been together about 6 weeks, 7 weeks. And she goes, you know, everybody at this school thinks you are the cockiest son of a bitch in the world. And I went, you got to be kidding me. I had no idea. It was a shock to me.
She like laid that on you six weeks in?
Yeah. And I said, I'm scared to death. I don't think I measure up. I don't think. Huh. And she goes, oh, I know that now. But your cover for your insecurity is kind of this. I got this attitude. I went, I had no idea that was what I was
projecting.
Well,
that's like a sense of humor. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, but it was, that's why I say when most people, so apparently the thing I...
Was she breaking up with you when you
No, no, she was a lovely woman. The thing I seem to project when I am my most uncomfortable or just is this kind of, oh man, he's comfortable in his skin and he knows what he can do.
Sure.
And nothing could be further from the truth. But so when I tell people that I was a very shy kid and that in fact, if you know, if we were close personal friends, people come to my house. Yeah, we'll play games and stuff. But I'm like, let's have a conversation.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, there's. I think I've lost some of my funnier friends because they go, he's not a lot of fun to hang.
Not anymore. No. Well, that's the weird thing because like, because we're serious.
I'm kind of serious.
Yeah. And there's that. You know, like the one thing I've learned over time that I protect the people in my life from, if I can, is dragging them down into whatever sad, shitty, neurotic hole that I'm in.
Yeah.
Because my brain wants to do it all it instinctively.
Sure. Absolutely.
So I got to know when it's happening and know like I'm about to say something that's got absolutely no floor to it.
Right.
And we're both gonna fall down. If I continue.
Absolutely.
You know that feeling?
Yeah. You bet.
Like the, we're all going to die. It's not.
I don't go to dark places, but I do go to serious places, you know?
Oh yeah. You don't have dread.
I don't live in dread because, you know, my life has been so friggin' blessed. It's not attractive to live in dread.
That's right. People are like, come on, shut up.
Yeah, it's just not.
That's true.
I haven't earned dread at this point.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess that you're not entitled to it.
No.
Though, you know, it's.
It's unseemly.
Yes, it's still scary, though. So when did you do magic for money?
I used to do kids' parties and stuff, and then I totally dropped it because I realized as a teenager, I wanted to be a close-up magician. I wanted to do cards and coins and that.
Do you enjoy it now?
I love magic, and I am a member of the Magic Castle, and I actually won an award for... I was asked to perform there in the early 2000s because they were having big financial trouble.
Uh-huh.
And I did a week in the parlor room, which is the mid-sized performance room, and I was actually very proud of that act, and... the magicians awarded me Parlor Magician of the Year that year. So I was very pleased. But I gave magic up because I realized when I was a teenager, I was never going to be good enough. And I knew the difference between good enough and not.
Yeah.
And I loved magic and I loved magicians. And I went, you know, I've got this theater thing. That's an illusion that I can do. And,
right.
So I was always a hobbyist, but all my aspirations about it went away.
When you see that stuff, is your brain automatically going, okay, so now I see what
he's saying?
So
I know the principles for almost all the stuff that I see.
Yeah.
What I love is, with knowing the principles, I don't see the moment.
Right.
And I go, that's great.
Right.
Because I love that.
Still
I
surprised.
Love being fooled. Yes, I love it. I love it. It makes me so happy to go, I know what you did and I don't know how you did it.
You know, some people, it's great.
It's great.
It's hard to be cynical about it, but I know people are. It's like, I think they're...
Oh, my wife hates it. My wife hates magic.
Really hates it?
Yeah. My wife's whole attitude about magic, she sums it up to this. There's a secret. You know it. I don't. You won't tell me. Go fuck yourself. That's her. She feels it's all a power
trip.
But
you just told me you don't know most of it.
I know. I don't see
it.
Understand it.
Right.
Most of it I understand. And then there's some things where I go, I don't even know what principle they're using for that.
Right.
Stuff.
Well, that's the
real thing. That makes me really happy.
Right. Because you're confounded.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do a card trick on your wife and she goes, yeah, it's my card. Fuck off.
As long as, if I do a trick for her, she immediately goes, all right, tell me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And do you?
For her, I have to, because otherwise it's an argument.
So that's the one condition that the
Absolutely.
Oath can be broken.
Yeah.
It's the same.
But Dana doesn't like surprises. Like, you would never throw my wife a surprise party.
No.
She'd be so pissed.
Angry.
Yeah.
It'd be like, surprise, get the fuck out of my...
She slammed the door on a friend of mine who came cross country to celebrate her birthday and didn't tell her. Just appeared at the door with a bag of New York bagels, and she went... Go fuck yourself and slam the door.
Really?
She got over it.
No, sure.
It makes her feel unsafe. It's, you know, she's a very organized,
Right.
She's not a control freak, but she is an organization freak. And she likes to know what's going to happen and be able to plan for it.
Sounds like a fine line.
And she feels like the people close to her should know that. And she forgot for a moment that it came from a good place. And, you know, she reopened the door and got over it.
Right.
But so the initial reaction was, oh, I hate you for doing this.
Right. It wasn't on the schedule.
No, it was not on the schedule.
Right. What does she do?
She's a painter.
Oh, yeah. I'm dating a painter.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Abstract painter.
Mine is not abstract. She's figurative and impressionistic and feminist and very, very good. She's been doing it. She was not doing that when I met her. She was an actress. We've been together forever. We've been together 38 years.
What's her painting name?
It's her name. It's Dana, and spelled D-A-E-N-A, and her last name is Title, like the title of a book.
Dana Title.
Yeah.
Yeah, painter, like, I it's interesting. They definitely live in their own world. They, you know, they, it's a very uniquely solitary thing, but they, you know, they do it. They go to
they
a
do.
Different place.
Yeah.
And being what we are, you know, which is, you know, people primarily driven by charm.
Right.
You just, all you can do is sit there baffled when they produce something like, where does that?
It's also a magic trick because I have no artistic ability whatsoever. Mm. And so she shows me the stuff she does and, you know, things look like things. And I go, I don't know how you took three dimensions and made it two. And it looks like it's three.
So she's got you. You can't figure out that trick.
No. And also, you know, one of the big, challenges for us is that visual art doesn't often speak to me. It feeds her soul. She can look at a painting the way I look at music.
Right.
And it changes who she is as a person. And I
don't get it.
Almost never have that reaction to anything visually. And so I'm less of a man in her eyes.
Well, I mean, you know, have you learned that maybe you just keep that to yourself?
It's too late.
You blew that one a long time ago. 38
years, that cat is out of the bag. Yeah.
Can't pretend?
No.
You're an actor. Can't you have the one moment? Just next time you go to the museum,
I've learned,
it's happening.
Yeah, I've learned to speak art a little better, and I've learned to speak to her art a little bit better.
I see that you did the thing with it.
I can talk some of the terms, but...
I just felt like there was a lot of fighting around this at some point. I felt it.
No, not fighting, disappointment.
Oh, geez.
Which is worse than fighting.
That's worse. That's like the Jewish curse.
Yeah. But I always say, you know, you didn't do this when we met. You changed the rules. You were an actress when I met you, or trying to be an actress when I met you, and we had everything going together. And now you decided this thing. Uh-huh. I never said I was that thing.
Yeah, right. Interesting. But so you guys were together before anything happened.
Yeah, we met in 1980. We were married in 82.
Yeah. So so you go to high school, and you do the theater kid thing, and then you get into BU, the theater program. Yeah. What year?
77.
So you graduated?
I didn't graduate. I finished 3 years, and I had been working professionally from the time I was 14. I sort of fell into a professional career.
What do you mean?
I was doing a children's theater in Livingston, or New Jersey, wasn't Livingston.
Yeah.
And they were doing little original children's musicals.
And you did that?
I was part of that company, and then some dad in the audience one day was a TV producer.
Yeah.
He said, this could be a cute little children's series, and he ponied up the money. We all joined AFTRA, and we shot a pilot. And he couldn't sell it as a series, but he got the pilot on local New York television, like a Sunday morning at 7:30 or something.
Oh, yeah.
And these managers for young people saw it and hunted me down and said, we'd love to rep you. And I went, okay.
At 14?
At 14. So I started doing commercials and that kind of stuff.
At 14, you're doing the commercials. Yeah. Were you making money, saving up for college?
Oh, yeah.
So you paid your own college?
Half of it.
Because of the commercials?
Yeah.
Doing all kinds of commercials?
Did a lot of commercials. In the 80s, commercials were amazing. I remember in the 1984 Olympics, I was doing a musical on Broadway. And the Olympics was that summer, and they went to a commercial break, and there was like, you know, I don't know, 8 to 10 commercials back to back. I was in 4 of them.
Oh, you were like that guy.
Uh-oh. They're on to me now.
Right. Well,
I'm overexposed.
But that happens with commercials. You see, like, well, that guy's in all of them now.
Yeah, it was not good. And actually, then it tamped down for a while. But commercials were great.
I watched the McDLT commercial
today. Yeah, yeah. I have the only McDonald's product that didn't go. Even the McRib comes back.
I think you were too excited about it.
I was excited as they told me to be.
I said that my producer, he said you should watch it, and I watched it, and I'm like, that didn't really hang around that long.
No,
I remember
it was
it.
It was a the product was not a bad idea. So what the McDLT was is that, you know, they had a two-container container.
Yeah.
And the idea was that the vegetable material would be on one bun on one side and the hamburger would be on the other, and it would wouldn't... All right. That worked as long as you built it level, you know, on the horizontal plane and put it in the bag that way and carried it out that way.
Yeah.
But the minute you put the thing in the bag... On the vertical, everything in the top fell to the bottom. They weren't sealed separate compartments. And it just, it was a mess. So people would open the box and they'd have just this salad of hamburger.
I also think that nobody wants to see the meat of a McDonald's hamburger. It's my belief.
You may be right.
That, like, you know, you just keep it covered.
Right. Yep.
You know, it's like, I know that that can't be good meat.
Yep.
It's McDonald's.
Yep. You just open its meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, you don't want to see all that meat.
It was a product that just would not catch at all. And
you, God, you danced the hell out of that product.
Well, the crazy thing is that behind me in that mob are some of Broadway's best dancers at the time. And I have never been accused of being a dancer, but somehow they put me in the foreground. I was an actor who moves, and I've done, in my Broadway career, I did more than my fair share of dancing.
I like it. I'm not mocking it. I just thought it was interesting that, you know, you are obviously directed to really be excited about that.
Oh,
yeah. And that all of that just couldn't do it.
Yes.
And those outfits.
I also, if you look at it, I have a Trump at the airplane moment at the very end, because my hair was already quite thin. And at the very end, there's a gust of wind. And what looks like a full head of hair on the top suddenly is revealed to be,
flips back.
He's becoming a monk very quickly. They left it in. That was the best take.
Oh, my God. So, all right. So you go to BU, which is a good theater school.
Yeah.
And what was it then? Like, because when I was there,
it was considered. It was in the. There was a league of theater schools.
82. I got there.
Yeah. It's still considered one of the better college programs.
But was like Julianne Moore there when you were there?
She was. Julianne was one or two years behind me.
Uh-huh.
Mike Chiklis was there. Gina Davis was there. Tassler was there. Jerry Levine was there.
And you didn't see Julianne when you were there?
I did.
You did?
Yeah, she was Julie Smith then.
Uh-huh.
And she was, the person she is now is exactly the person she was then. She was as sweet and kind and lovely.
Did you see her early stuff there?
I think she was 2 years behind me, and the freshmen were not allowed to do the big shows.
Uh-huh.
So I may have seen her in a scene here and a scene there, and then I didn't do my senior year, which is when she would have started to be cast. So,
but like, what did you learn there? How you just bailed on your senior year? Why? Because you got
bail. I did a movie.
What movie?
Oh, God.
What are you doing?
It's one of these horrible movies. It was a movie. It was Harvey Weinstein's first movie.
Uh-huh.
It was a little horror film a la Friday the 13th called The Burning.
Uh-huh.
Summer camp terrorized.
Weinstein's first movie. So you knew him at the beginning.
I was aware of him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I knew him. We didn't hang. Excuse me. And
he was just a producer.
He was a producer. I think Harvey and his brother were concert promoters in Buffalo, New York at the time. And they wanted to get into this, and as far as I know, it was their first film. And it ran late. It went late. So I didn't get back to school in time to start the last year. And I was going to take one semester off. And I got a very good gig in New York, and I decided to stay and do that. And then gig led to gig, and I never got back.
What were you learning there?
Were you prepared? Advanced walking and talking.
Yeah.
I
mean, did you feel like, you know, like, all right, you got the movie. Who's the guy that I took a class with up there? Was his name Bill Young? I
think Bill Young. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Because I went to BU, but I was not. I did stage troupe, but I took class. Mm-hmm. Took a class up there as an elective.
Smart. You did it the right way.
Yeah, because I thought it was a whole. Yeah, I thought they were really trying to be like a complete program, like Yale.
They are. I do a lot of teaching these days, and I teach a lot of. I go around and do master classes at universities
in acting.
Yeah. And I honestly don't believe that the best training for anyone in the arts is at a college. And not because they don't have good teachers and not because they don't have good curriculum. Uh-huh. But by the very nature of a college program, they're on a schedule. And artists learn a craft in the time it takes them to learn it.
Yeah.
But the college needs you to go on to the next thing.
Right.
So you find that you are burning through ideas before you really grok them.
But this is that with anything in college.
That's correct.
Unless you're doing something, even English. Unless you're doing something like engineering or something.
Right.
Like,
if it's math and science, you kind of have a barometer for you need to know this before you can
do that. Yeah, because that's why everybody says, I wish I'd go to college now.
Right. If I were to go again, so my older son, who's in this business, he went to Yale, and he went as a theater major, but that's not a conservatory program. So he actually got an education. He got a great education.
What does that mean, it's not a conservatory?
So all I studied at BU, because it's a conservatory-style program, is I was doing movement, vocal production, acting technique, history of the theater, and stagecraft. And I had like one or two electives every semester.
Yeah, that's right. You guys had to take like an elective in liberal arts.
Right, but I had no math or science requirements. I had no language requirements. I did not need to get a real education of any kind. I was solely focused on the craft that I was studying.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think doing that at a college, I wouldn't recommend it for my kids.
Because like, what if you get out and the odds are against you?
Well, so that's true no matter where you study.
That's what I mean is that like, you know, at least with a few other things, you're a little more well-rounded.
Right.
So when you get out and you can't get a job in the theater, you don't go apply it in restaurants showing them your swordsmanship.
And even in the theater programs, the whole notion right now, and this is I'm on the dean's advisory board for BU, for this college. And the thing we keep talking about is even the name, College of Theater.
Yeah,
you go,
right.
No actor is making their living solely in the theater. So this is a misnomer. It should be the College of Performing Art, because you need to understand film. You need to understand television.
They changed you, right?
You need to, not yet.
Right.
Not yet. It is still a hyper-focused, and it's not just Boston University. It's all of these guys.
But so wait, they don't teach, like you're saying that they should
integrate.
There
is no business of the theater. There is no other medium. There's not a real immersion into other medium. There's no idea. I came out of college. I didn't know. If I wanted to put up a play, if I wanted to take a space and put up a play, I didn't know how to budget it.
Right.
I didn't know what a stage manager
does. So there should
be
that option.
Of
production.
Course. It should be
production.
An immersion. You want to, if you're going to teach a performing art, yes, you have to teach the technical of the trade, but you got to teach people to go out and be entrepreneurs. They got to be able to do the business of this craft.
But don't you know how that happens? The old school way is you go out, you fail as an actor, and you like, I kind of like this world, though.
Right.
And then you go talk to the guy, the director.
But
you go
much
talk
like
to
you're
the producer.
Doing here, I mean, when Howard Stern graduated BU, there was no such thing as a podcast. He had to get a job in somebody's radio station or he was out of work. Now, there's no reason an actor can't work every day, but they got to know how to make their own stuff. They have to know how to develop material and put things together.
I think so. I guess,
you know,
so.
It's a whole new world.
It is, but you know, in some ways, you can get deluded. You know, in the sense that, like, there's something about taking your hits, and I think that self-producing, at a certain level, you think you're doing something.
Well, you are doing something. Even if you fail, you're doing something.
Yeah, but how do you know if you succeed or fail? I'm saying, like, anyone can put something out into the world.
Right.
But, how does it get traction? What does it mean?
That's,
what the hell difference does it make?
That's the big challenge.
How do you make money?
Brave New World is that. How do you monetize what we do? What barometer is success? But I know more actors that sat around, that are gone now. They don't work. They're out of our business. Why? Because they had nothing in their quiver other than to sit around with their talent and hope to Christ that somebody threw a job or an opportunity at them. Because they couldn't
Were they talented?
Else. Oh, yeah. I went to school with some people that, you've never heard of that
sure.
I thought were some of the most talented people I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I've known guys like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, what about isn't there a natural sort of thinning of the herd?
Sure, yeah.
That, I think one of the things that we see now is that there are more opportunities if you can find them.
Yes.
But some people are just not cut out for this shit.
That's absolutely right. That's true. But I'd love to see what I think is exciting about these times is that if you are willing to try and create your own opportunity, you can. When I was a kid, you really couldn't.
Right. You needed, there were gatekeepers.
The means of doing it were too tough. There's,
but all that stuff is still there. And the level of, it is true. It's determining what is success. Making a living.
Absolutely.
Is important, And, it's hard to say that, like, even something like, would in the media landscape we live in now, would a Seinfeld ever even happen again?
Never.
It just won't.
Well, we wouldn't have survived. We were so not a hit. We weren't producing, from my understanding, we weren't producing enough of an audience. The only reason we kind of kept going is that the audience we were getting was the demographic that it was very hard to get. It was guys, 18 to 35.
Right.
So advertisers would throw some coins at us, but
right.
we had no, we did not have an audience that would have sustained a TV show in that day and age or this day and age.
So. Right. Yeah. And now because there's so many different, there's so many great shows on you. Like, where Absolutely. Is it? Well, I don't even know where that is. What is it called? I don't know. What's it on? Yeah. But like, what do you teach? So what's the structure when you say you go out and
teach? When I left college, I mean, every school does a very fine job of introducing theater students to the tools of the craft, which I didn't even know existed when I went in. I thought you just memorize the lines and pretend to be the actor you thought would be good in the role. But that was my idea of acting.
Did you learn the tools?
I did.
And did
they
help
introduced me to the tools. But what they didn't do, and might have gone further had I done my final year. But they, so if you teach
you think
me,
you might have done, had a better career.
I might have done a little bit better. I always use this analogy. If you know nothing about construction, I show you how to use a hammer. I show you how to use a drill. I show you how to use a saw. I show you how to use the tools.
Yeah.
The tools. This is how a saw works.
Right. Don't hurt yourself.
And now I say, okay, go build a house. Right. You don't know how to build a house.
Yeah.
You don't have a methodology to use those tools to create something.
Yeah.
So when I left school and I started finding different teachers, looking for that clarity. It took me a couple of years, and then I met Larry Moss, and I studied with
out
Larry.
Here.
Yeah, actually, I met Larry in New York, and then I studied with him several years there, and then he moved here. And when I got here, I resumed study with Larry, and I did about 12 years with Larry, on and off.
One on one class?
No, class. Larry, among having his own students, used to teach at Circle and the Square in New York, and that's where my wife met him.
Uh-huh.
Sang his praises to the sun and the stars. And I did a little workshop in New York when I, you know, like I was 2 years out of school.
Yeah.
And he had two students in it who I thought were spectacular. And he came to a performance and he said, came right up to me afterwards and went, "You're very good, but I can make you much better."
Oh, yeah.
And so I joined with him. But Larry introduced me to a methodology that I could understand to plug those tools in.
Right.
And that's basically what I teach. I've built on what he gave me and some things that I've discovered along the way. And I go to actors that go, I know all the, but if I say to an actor, okay, I give you a piece of material. How do you do what you do? And they go, well, I kind of, and most actors, that's the answer. I kind of this, I kind of that. It's a little bit instinctual. I never do the
Ask
same thing
Ask me, because I'm acting now.
All right, go ahead. So what do you do?
Well, I read the script.
Yeah, that's good.
I read the material.
Yeah.
I start to, you know, I say the lines out loud.
Uh-huh.
I read them out loud a little bit.
Sure.
I'll decide, I'll make some choices reading.
How do you do that?
Well, how do I read the lines or how,
no,
do,
how
I
do you make
the choices?
Choices?
Well, from reading out loud, I can try to understand how it's being said and what I can do to, you know, make it my own.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then I'll start memorizing.
Uh-huh.
And then I got to wait till the other guy comes to move around in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's what most actors do.
Yeah.
Part of that actually is you know, unavoidable. You're going to do that.
Well, I don't have much training. So take me to the next level.
So what actors have to make choices about is... You're carefully and selectively building the illusion that somehow you are this person inhabiting these circumstances in this world.
Yeah.
So the first thing I talk about, I have actors come in and they start with monologues.
Yeah.
And in a monologue, they're talking to somebody. I go, "Who are you talking to?"
Yeah.
They go, "What?" I go, "Who are you talking to?"
Wait, you.
If you have not
talking
put,
to you.
I mean, it's one thing to feel the words and feel the material, which is part of what you're talking about. You get into a space, either here or somewhere, and you start to say the words out loud, and you see how they affect you and you affect them. Okay.
But I know who I'm talking to. I'm on a show. So like, I know the other people.
You know the idea of who you're talking
to.
But you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know who they are. You haven't. So, for instance, if
I do because I'm on a show. But like you're saying in the monologue,
yeah. But even so, what I love are
but like
are
when you read a Seinfeld script, and it says Jerry on there, you know what's going
to
happen.
But who is Jerry to George?
A friend.
What does that mean? Why are friends friends?
Uh huh.
Well, now what makes a friend a friend? What do you get from a friend that makes them a friend? And on Seinfeld, it's going to be the exact opposite of anything you answer.
Uh-huh.
Because mostly we're friends with people who we have a natural simpatico with.
Sure.
Our ethics, our ideas, our creativity, they line up.
Right.
I feel somehow appreciated by that person.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of reasons friends are friends. So for an actor, specifics are your best friend. Specifics. Mm-hmm. What? The more you can go, I specifically have this, the deeper and richer your work goes.
I see.
So when you have an actor that comes in, he's doing Hamlet. He's doing a scene between Hamlet and Gertrude, his mother.
Right.
And I go, "Who are you talking to?" And he goes, "Well, the character's talking to his mother." I go, "Uh-huh. but the character doesn't exist. This is somebody's idea on a piece of paper. You're a real person pretending to be this person.
Yeah.
So are you talking to Hamlet's mother? Because she doesn't exist either. So who are you talking to?
Uh-huh.
And now
what's
they
the
have
right
to,
answer?
The answer is, what is the relationship between Hamlet and his mother?
Right.
Is it, in some productions, it's an incestuous relationship in his mind. In some productions, it's a hateful relationship. In some productions, it's a lost relationship where so you have to decide who Hamlet's mother is to Hamlet. And then in order to explore that, in order to say those words out loud in a way that is guaranteed to affect you, you have to create a mother.
Right.
It has to be. And when people say, well, I used my mother, I go, well, what does that mean? How many roles does your mother play in your life? Which mother are you talking to? And so everybody goes.
And then they say, I have a very complicated relationship with my mother.
Everybody believes it is simple, and it can't. And ultimately, all this complexity is to get back to something very, very simple and organic and instinctual. But most
the groundwork.
Actors.
That's the groundwork. Yeah.
And most actors, and by the way, good actors, great actors, better actors than me, a lot of them are just instinctual. They don't know how they do what they're doing. They just feel it. They get there.
You're okay with that.
But I do theater.
Right.
And I got to tell you, at 6 months in on a Thursday night, I ain't feeling shit. So I better have some technique behind me in order to create this illusion for the audience that something's happening there.
That's what it's for.
Yeah. And this is something that really affects theater actors more than film actors, because film actors have to get there once.
Yeah.
Theater actors have to get there over and over and over and over. And I was trained for, and all my fantasies of a career were about being a theater actor. And all this other stuff was just gravy and icing on the cake.
That's what you wanted.
That's all I imagined. I thought if God was good to me, I would somehow wind up working in the New York theater. That was my fantasy of success.
But movies were not part of it.
I didn't think about them.
Uh-huh.
I didn't think I would
be
a movie.
Why'd you love theater so much?
I was always excited. Whenever I went to first of all, that's how I became an actor. I got pulled into this theater company.
I know, but then you go see theater and you'd be just
absolutely
astounded.
I love the greatest nights of my life have been nights spent either on the stage or in the audience of a stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I love it because, again, my thing is magic. Magic gets me off. That is the most exciting illusion in the world. Nothing on that stage is real.
What's the best?
Nothing.
Yeah.
And yet you suspend all. But people sit in a magic show and go, yeah, he didn't saw a woman. And nobody goes, oh, come on, he wasn't her father. Yeah. They don't do that.
Yeah, that's not a real apartment.
So it's a very exciting illusion that you can really get people to invest in, but you have to do it well. And everybody has to do it well at the same time.
But, you know, as you became more professional, the thrill was not losing yourself. It was doing the job, right? I mean, or do you still...
The thrill was the detective, case of who is this person? What is this event? How do I get there?
Building the character.
Yeah,
and then,
I went from, I hate rehearsing, I can't wait to perform because I so desperately needed the affirmation.
Right.
To, I could, which is why I try now to do more directing than acting, because I don't crave or need the applause. I love the discovery process.
And to be part of the ensemble.
Yeah.
And working with an ensemble.
Yeah.
What were some of the like mind-blowing kind of things that really, you know, kept you excited about theater? If you're going to so much theater at that time when you're younger, like you must have seen a lot of great stuff in New York.
I saw a lot of great. I saw a lot of terrible.
Sure. But like, were there performances where you're like, holy shit?
The performance that made me go, I have to do this.
Yeah.
Was Ben Vereen and Pippin.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And I'm not alone in that. I've known Ben. We're not friends, but I've been at things with him and gotten to chat with him. And a lot of people had that experience. He was so extraordinary in that piece. And it was so theatrical and so magical and so charismatic that it made a lot of people go, I have to try and do that.
Yeah.
And it stayed with me. I know his readings. I know his, that performance is...
That was
raised it. In my mind. But I saw amazing things. I saw Anthony Hopkins do Equus on Broadway.
I saw Malkovich in Burn This.
Burn, absolutely. With that three-page rant that he comes on with.
And that wig.
And he couldn't find a parking
space.
Hair. Yeah. I mean, it's those things that just go, oh my God, I was here when that happened. And it's living and breathing right in front of me. And even the I love musicals, and I know there are people that genetically just hate musicals.
I genetically, I'm repressed musical lover.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't seek them out, but when I go, I'm always like, oh, I love them.
I get crazy of them. I love them. When they're good.
There's something, right? It's like magic. As soon as people start singing, I get all teared up.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I do not know what it is about many people singing on a stage.
Because there's something about... You know, we as a creature raise our voice in song at the heightened moments of our lives. They're either celebratory or they are at our deepest despair. That's when we sing.
Really?
And so I think the act of lifting into music, just whether you are aware of it or not,
you tap into that. Where'd you learn that?
Life. Observation.
That sounded like a study.
Certainly not in college. They didn't teach me that in my...
So now why you did, it looks like you, before Seinfeld, I don't know what your timeline is, but you were on stage constantly in New York.
You
were like a Broadway guy.
Yeah, so Seinfeld happened around 1990, and I came out of college in 1980, and I spent the 80s primarily doing Broadway and off-Broadway and commercials.
Yeah.
And with a little bit of a tiny film or a tiny TV thing here and there.
Right, but you were content.
Extremely. I never thought I'd... I didn't think life could get better.
Because you were on stage all the time.
I was a working theater actor in New York City making a fine living. I was putting money in the bank every year. My wife and I lived great. And I didn't think anything beyond.
And you had the craft blessed. In place that would enable you 6 months
I was getting it. I mean, you know, I was still... But in the 80s, I was really putting pieces together.
But I think that's important what you said, because I just talked to somebody else about that specific thing, about maybe it was Tracy Letts, about you know, like 6 months in, where you know, when you got nothing, but you got to do it, that's the
Absolutely.
Job. You know, that's a hell of a thing to know.
Yeah.
I know it as a comic, too, that like, you know, I've dragged some audiences down the garbage hole.
Yeah.
After a certain point, when people are coming to see you,
right,
that you've gone to, you know, save that for your own head. Yeah.
You bet.
You earn it. But so you're doing that, and then you do this other thing, this like world-changing thing for a decade.
There were three things that happened back-to-back, and it changed my life. One was winning the Tony Award in 1989. For a show that I had no idea would even put me in the running for such a thing, because I didn't really, it was a dance review, and I was an actor in a dance review, but it was flashy enough, and it got me a Tony. Somehow,
which one?
It was called Jerome Robbins Broadway.
Yeah.
It was a big celebration of Jerome Robbins.
And you were singing and dancing?
I was singing and dancing and playing a bunch of characters. Won the Tony, and then somehow that put me in Gary Marshall's purview, and I got Pretty Woman.
Oh yeah.
And the Gary Marshall to Rob Reiner to Jerry Seinfeld connection began to get me.
Because Reiner was a partner at Castle Rock.
Right. And Rob was married to Penny at that point.
Right. So. Oh wow. And then Glenn, what's his name at Castle Rock? What was Glenn's name?
Padnick.
Yeah. Glenn Padnick.
Yeah.
I had a weird meeting with Glenn Padnick after Seinfeld. I was coming in pitching something, and he just couldn't be more thrilled about how it went with Seinfeld. So,
oh yeah, I'm sure they were all still in shock.
Yeah, like whatever I was pitching.
Yeah, is this 2018? They're still going. I can't believe we did that.
Yeah. So whatever I was pitching was like, let me tell you, with Seinfeld. Okay. But okay. So all those things happen.
Yeah.
And then everything it changes, right? So then you're Costanza for a decade.
Yeah.
And you love it.
Yeah, for the most part, the time I was there. I got a little cranky with it in the last 2 years. When Larry David left after season 7, I felt like the best of George went with him, because, you know, Larry, that was the alter ego he was writing. And I and the writing staff at that point, all unbelievably talented guys who have gone on to huge careers.
Yeah.
But I felt like they didn't quite understand George to the depths that Larry did. So the stories were a little less interesting to me.
Yeah.
But that may have just been the fatigue of you doing this gig for 9 years, you know, so.
Right, and that's where I guess that theater craft had to come in.
Yeah. But the doing of the show was always a joy.
Right.
You know,
live being audience. There,
well, not even that, but just being there for the week and playing right. with everybody and right. figuring out what the show was going to be. And, you know, the great thing about doing that show was it was just, we would go and laugh. We would yeah. just go down and laugh and try and put this thing together.
Yeah.
Then other people would laugh and we'd go home and get a check. It made no sense as a job.
There's a lot of work, though. Come on. Once you're shooting, no. I mean, some of those shows were big.
I swear to you, I wish I could say to you, oh, what a grind. It was not. It wasn't for Julia and Michael and I. I'm sure it was for Jerry because he wore 50 hats on that show. But we went from a 5-day week to a 4-day week. Two of those days were less than 8 hours, and yeah. sometimes by a long shot, less than 8 hours. And then two longer days, but it was, we were having fun.
Sure.
Nothing about it was hard. We weren't
and it was
out in the hot sun laying tar.
And you're on a set too, which is a big
deal. We were mostly on a soundstage or on our back lot.
Right.
It was a gift. It was just a gift, that job.
And you moved out here to be, right?
I moved out. We started in 90, and in 92, my wife and I got pregnant. We had been going back and forth, and I went, I don't think we're going to, the kid. And so we were not a sure thing by any stretch of the imagination yet, but I went, let's roll the dice, and we let our New York apartment go, and we bought
it. Wow, you didn't even save it, huh?
No, well, we didn't own it. We couldn't.
Right. But even if it was rent control?
We couldn't. You know what it was? We had the upper two floors of a 3-story townhouse.
Yeah.
And so it was just the people that owned it and us. So we couldn't sublet it.
Yeah.
And we couldn't put a place. It was not expensive if you live there, but when you're carrying two rents, it was more than we could bear. So
sure. Yeah. So you come out here and you do it. You do it for a decade, basically.
Yeah.
Were you ready for it to end?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Jerry tells the story the same way. I mean, ultimately, everything was his decision. But starting around season 6, at the Christmas break, we'd all sit down, the four of us would sit down, and he goes, what do you think? We got more in us? And we go, yeah. And season 9, season 8, we kind of went, yeah. And season 9, you know, we didn't go into 9 knowing it was going to be the end.
Yeah.
It was an inkling. But around Christmas, he went, I'm thinking we're done, guys. And none of us went, oh, no. We all went, I think so.
Yeah.
Not because it wasn't funny. I mean, the writers were glorious. They could have been funny forever.
Why did Larry go?
You couldn't surprise anybody anymore. You know what these characters are going to do. What are we doing? Yeah. Stretching this out? You'd have to ask Larry ultimately why he left. I think it was always, you know, we laugh at how Larry couldn't handle the success of it, but he always, from my understanding, he always saw the doing of Seinfeld as a very stressful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, if it broke, it was going to be him and Jerry that broke it, but I think he took more of that responsibility. Huh. And we would finish every taping, you know, he's got a whole season arc laid out on a whiteboard somewhere. But we'd finish every taping and he'd go, it can't be done again. That's it. It can't be done. And he would, you know, like they had no idea for next week. And you have an idea, you got a draft.
Right.
I mean, but he would feel that pressure very acutely. And I think after 7 years and the money he'd made, he went, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
And Jerry felt like he had a little more left.
And it's interesting to me that, like, you know, after you do this, like, you go on, you do movies, you do animated movies, you do a series of your own briefly, and you just kept working.
Yeah, by that point, I had started to believe, because I always believed when Seinfeld started to hit, I went, oh, I'm done.
Yeah.
Because at that point, historically, if you were on a hit TV show and you played an iconic character
forever,
you were done. You weren't invited to the party anymore. So I said, I better start diversifying and maybe trying to start a few things. So I started doing a lot of solo. I started doing because I was a singer, I could do symphony shows with pop orchestras. I started doing that.
That's right. Yeah.
I started doing a lot of corporate hosting gigs where it was light stand up because I was never a stand up, but my writing partner and I could come up with just enough for that.
But what was that? So this was just to earn a living. You were just trying.
It was more to do stuff. I didn't. I was 40.
You weren't
Seinfeld, and I wasn't quite ready to.
Sure.
You know. Buy a boat and go sail.
Right.
So, and I had fell into a production company deal from a movie, So I had a production company for 10 years. We were always developing TV and film, and I just never had a lot of clout, and I wasn't, I think ultimately, I wasn't very good at it. I was good at part of the job, but not all the job.
Uh-huh.
And my TV series, you know, so the first one out after Seinfeld was this thing, Bob Patterson, which is a show that I will go to my grave going, good show,
worthy show. Right.
There were a couple things on it that I think if we had done a second season, we would have figured it out and fixed. But if I go back and look at them, they're funny. It was a real unique idea. We went on the air days after 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody was laughing.
No.
We were up against
Frasier.
Tough
audience. Yeah.
We had a lot of things structurally going against us. And one of the things that I've never been fortunate to have since Seinfeld was a bulletproof part of the team.
Right.
A guy who was much higher up the food chain than me. I was always hovering near the top of the food chain on the product.
Yeah.
And I was not strong enough to have that role.
Right.
So when the going got tough, I didn't have the experience to know how to fix it or play the politics or whatever was needed. And so they would ultimately crash.
Oh, to get a series over the top.
To keep it going. You know, when part of it is just creative.
Right.
And part of it is kind of knowing how to play the game. Who's repping you? How do you...
Oh, right. Right. How do you get your agent to muscle the producer?
I'm still a dummy about that stuff.
I'm a dummy too, but is that you but that doesn't seem to be a foolproof thing, you know?
No, it's just helpful. It can get you over a hump. And I felt like with Bob Patterson, we hit a hump, and if we could have gotten over it, I think we would have been okay, but we could not get
Didn't have enough people at bat for you.
No, and we had a tough situation. Nobody's fault. But we had two competing studios co-producing that show. So,
oh, yeah. So
and you
many
go,
people,
who,
yeah.
who am I? I'm getting notes from everybody. Who do
yeah,
I listen
yeah.
to?
Right.
I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were on ABC, and at the time, ABC had two presidents.
Yeah.
And one of them kind of liked us, and I think the other one really, really didn't kind of like us.
Yeah,
and so there was an internal conflict there, and it just everything about it was not set up for success.
Yeah, that's the one thing that people don't always realize is that, you know, you have your thing, but then no one knows, like, what the fuck is going on a corporate level, who
Absolutely.
Just left,
yeah.
who's coming in, you know, who do they like, who they not like.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not just as easy as, like,
yeah,
you
it's
know,
not all. It's not just, oh, it's a really funny show, and I like
yeah,
these guys.
Or, yeah,
there's
or,
a lot more going on.
Yeah, or
and,
even
and
ratings.
That was the part that I did not know or did not understand.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking part when you like, yeah. which is sort of the sense that what you're talking about teaching younger people today about taking more control over their stuff.
Yeah,
is that you usually don't have it.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, no matter how big you were, how big an actor you are, whatever, if you can't sell a million tickets, then you still got to be like, I got to do that. I got to wear that.
That's right. Yeah.
You want us to do what?
Yep.
Yeah. But that didn't work. All right. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now when you do all these other parts where you do like two episodes here, little episode arcs, guest characters,
mm-hmm.
do you do it because you love it?
Yeah, it's a combination. I try not to do something where I'm not attracted to the piece or the people doing it. But sometimes, I mean, there's nothing you do for the money anymore. Thank you, Jerry and God.
Yeah.
Or... could be the same person for Elena.
don't tell him that.
But but you do like to, you like to go, I want to make sure I still know how to do this.
Right.
I'd rather work than not work.
Right.
Given the choice.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't want to do something that I don't believe has any merit. You know, if you have a little reputation and you do something, you're kind of saying to the audience, I think you're going to like this.
Yeah.
I never want to not be thinking that when I go in.
Right.
So I get a little picky with that. But generally, I like to work. I like to work with younger folks and see what's on their mind and mm-hmm. what's going mm-hmm. on. But generally, if somebody who I respect is doing something and it's being done with integrity and they invite me on board, I generally will go.
Yeah. And do you seek movies?
I don't think anybody in our business doesn't seek movies.
Sure.
I don't think they're looking for me. I mean, if the recent Oscars, I have had nothing in contention for about 10 years. So.
Yeah. I guess it gets hard. I guess, you know, it's like... It's
I never thought I was a movie guy.
Yeah.
I find that people in movies, my stock and trade is I'm kind of an everyman.
Yeah.
I remind everybody of somebody.
Yeah.
I find that movies are populated by people that really have a very distinctive... they walk on the screen, you go, got it.
Yeah.
Got it. And I'm not that
movie guy. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it may be a combination of they don't want George.
Yeah.
And that is a thing for some of them. They don't want an iconic, recognizable thing. Or they may not think, you know.
Yeah, but it's weird. You know, I can separate you from George now sitting here talking to you. I imagine that that's a relief, isn't it?
It is. you know, I also say, you know, the audience doesn't watch Tom Hanks as Sully Sullenberger and go, oh, Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's not a thing. But
it is odd that some people can completely transcend iconic roles on television.
I know.
But it's not many.
No.
It's just really, it's wild.
Have, you know, I have nothing on it. The truth is, I have loved doing movies on the couple of occasions where I've been the director.
Yeah.
I find every minute of it exciting.
Yeah.
As an actor, I find many of the minutes not so exciting. You know?
Oh, guys, it's a lot of minutes.
It's a lot of minutes. And you're always hot or cold or tired or...
The trailer's, you know, not great.
Yeah. Or you're not home and you...
Oh, yeah.
It's,
you got a lot of time.
I tip my hat to the movie people because it's you're out of your life.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's a hard existence.
Now, what about stage?
Yeah, love it. I just finished a piece in New York I was doing from August to Christmas.
What was that?
It was a new John Patrick Shanley play at Manhattan Theater Club.
And so you're still doing a lot of that?
I do now. I kept theater outside of L.A. at an arm's distance when my kids were young.
Right. You can do it.
But now they're grown-ups.
That's so, right.
Yeah, so now I'm going to do it again.
Like, what are you hoping to play? I mean, The Producers was great. And right? And you did Larry's play.
Did Larry's play, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what would you, like, if they bring back something, what would you want to...
There's only one part in the theater that I pine for, and I'm probably a little old to play it at this point. I always
Peter
wanted
Pan?
To do, and you, it's not something that people would think of me for, but I always wanted to do Sweeney Todd.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because if you're going to do a role that somebody's done, I always think, well, what can I bring to it that makes it worth doing for an audience? And I think there are things about Sweeney Todd that I haven't seen an actor incorporate or deal with.
Wow.
And that I think could be really exciting.
What about non-musical traditional drama?
There's nothing I pine for.
Yeah.
You know, there's no... Right.
You don't want to play Willie Loman?
I would, you know, if it was the right production, I would be excited to do it. I don't know that I'm going to reinvent the wheel on Willie Loman. I don't think, you know, I mean, I didn't get to see Philip Seymour Hoffman do it.
Mm.
And the response critically to him was that he reinvented the role. I would have loved to have seen that because that's such a rare thing to be able to take a role like that and not step into echoes of what has been done before.
Right.
If he was able to do that, I really would have loved to have witnessed.
Sorry,
that,
I missed it. They didn't tape it, huh?
No.
Well, it seems like you're good.
Life is, baseball's been very good to me.
How old are your kids?
My younger one is about to turn 22, and my older one will be 26 in May.
Wow.
Yeah. He's doing good. He's a good actor and a very funny guy. He's got a two-man sketch comedy team here in town, does a lot of improv. And
where are they working at? UCB? Or?
He does mostly, they work out of the I.O. space.
Oh, yeah?
But he's done UCB, he's done Groundlings, he's done all that stuff, and he's with like seven improv teams in town.
That's the new thing.
Well, it gets them, it's great. It's the 10,000-hour thing, you know? It's get up and do something.
But like improv in particular, I think that's one of those things, like what you're talking about. Like I've noticed just from, like even from Seinfeld days, that the model for what, you know, what makes a show.
Right.
Like it used to be, we got a comic, he's got a point of view, we build a show around it.
Right.
But these people that come up through sketch and the improv, they learn very, right at the beginning, how to work with other people,
absolutely,
how to direct, how to put things together.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really where it's at.
And that's the new world. That's kind of what I'm talking about. So my son Gabe has this whole network of young writers, filmmakers, directors, you know, that so he's constantly doing stuff.
Right.
Eventually, one of those things is going to make a difference.
That is where it happens. It's the improv community.
Yeah.
Improv and sketch community.
It's very exciting. And they're all, you know, normally
good
I
kids.
Go. They are good kids. And normally I go to these things and I go, I'm not hip to what they're doing. his stuff, I go, wow, that's really smart. That's really funny and really smart.
And you get it and it works.
Yeah.
Do you ever do improv?
I've done it. I've never studied it. Right. You know, I've looked at it and I've jumped into it. And,
oh, yeah.
And I can hold my own. You know, I don't know the rules. I don't know all the things. You know, always say yes and I go, well, see, the difference between improv and acting, and you'll know. Acting, scenes become interesting the minute there's conflict.
Yeah.
The minute there's a conflict, something starts to happen.
Yeah.
In improv, they go, yes.
Yeah.
And I go, so my instinct in improv is for a guy to go, the ship is sinking. Yes, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If you do this, well, I can't do that, but you must do this. And then I go, now I'm in a scene.
Right.
My son will go, yeah, that, you fucked it up.
You can't improv.
Yeah.
So do you ever go back to Jersey?
I don't have family in Jersey.
What happened to Bruce Davidson?
Bruce Davidson, when last I understand, is a doctor in Illinois.
Okay.
Doing quite well. I saw him, I think the last time I saw him, he brought his kids to L.A. and we all went down to the farmer's market
and had
lunch down there and caught up a little bit.
Yeah, because he's the one guy you mentioned.
He had three sisters, and his three sisters came to see me do a play in New York. I can't remember if it was Larry's play or this last one. But
yeah, so. And you talked to everybody from the show still?
No.
Nobody.
Well, not nobody, but I hardly ever communicate with Jerry.
Yeah.
Michael, I don't even know where Michael is.
Yeah.
And Julia, well, Julia's been going through her thing. So I adore Julia.
Yeah.
I just haven't heard from her, so I don't know how she's doing. I've sent her some emails.
Good. I hope she's doing getting through it.
God, I hope so.
Yeah.
Larry occasionally. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, my closer relationships from that show are people like Patrick Warburton, Bryan Cranston, some of the bench,
right?
Jerry Stiller.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, the four of us, and I hope it doesn't make people sad or think we're odd, but Jerry, Julia, Michael, and I were never really social friends. So we didn't like shoot the show on Friday and go, hey, let's have dinner tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. No,
so when the show ended, we had no history of that.
That's what happens. You know? It's a very odd thing that, you know, you create this illusion for people of this unity.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when you're done, you're done. I was on the radio for a couple of years with a guy. We never did nothing.
Right.
And
I just saw Penn and Teller in Vegas. And, you know, I'm always amazed at that relationship because they're really just professional colleagues.
Yeah.
They don't really socialize. They don't hang out.
How could you on some level?
It's kind of brilliant because what I found with our show is that I had such limited expectations of anything outside of the set that I was never disappointed.
Right.
You know, it's like, I didn't expect them to come to my openings. I didn't expect them to, you know, send me birthday cards. It just wasn't that thing.
It's so work.
It was a great place to go to work. Absolutely. Yeah.
And at the sound of the jackhammer, that's when we got to wrap it up.
Oh, is that what it is? It was a pleasure, Mark.
Great talking to you.
Nice
I'm glad
you.
We did it.
Thank you.
That's it. That's our show. I hope you enjoyed that. Jason again at the New Jersey Performance Arts Center in Newark and State Theater in New Brunswick, April 14th and 15th with the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. I will be go to WTFpod.com/tour for my Europe dates. I'm coming to London, Oslo, Amsterdam, Stockholm, and Dublin in a couple weeks. And I have yet to set up the guitars, so bear with me. We're in the new space. I'm surrounded by foam, being held in place by dowels, by tape on a stand. And I'll get the guitars going soon, and I'll get that mic up soon. I'm just trying to get settled in. All right? Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.